Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, with occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrat Robert Creamer, Republican Dan Proft, and Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago. A program coming to you tonight from our home base at the Sirius XM Studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our phone lines are open toll-free at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you have an email address or email comment for us, you can give us an email at btb@museum.tv. That's btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it's beyondthebeltway.com, where this broadcast will be streamed, and it'll be saved for many, many years. So if you miss it tonight, you can come back and listen to it and watch it, because we offer the video version as well at beyondthebeltway.com. Tonight we're going to begin by talking about what we should do with the detainees, the prisoners at Guantanamo. Last week, the House Appropriations Committee stripped $50 million after reauthorizing funding for the Iraq and Afghan war. They stripped $50 million from the bill because Republicans and Democrats agreed that the administration did not yet have its plan in place as to where the 240 detainees should go. Bob Creamer, you're our liberal Democrat tonight. Nice to have you with us. It's been a while since you've been on the show. What's your answer? You are one of those that have wanted to close Guantanamo for a long time.
Absolutely right.
Okay. We know why. Well, tell the audience why, first of all.
Well, I mean, Guantanamo is one of the most symbolically detrimental things we've done in years for the United States. It's a symbol that's used to recruit terrorists and people who don't like America all over the world. It needs to be closed for that reason, but also because it's we started this whole process by putting people in categories that were not, on the one hand, compliant with the Geneva Conventions, or on the other hand, it is part of our criminal justice
system. For the sake of the argument, let's say that I agree with everything you said. Now, what do you do with 240 detainees now that the president has said we want to close it?
Well, to the extent that you have difficulty dealing with them in the judicial system between now and the time that closes, some of them will presumably go to some other countries. Some of them need to be kept here in the United States. And of course, the notion, not having these people, we have terrorists in the United States at high-security federal prisons all over the United States. We have mass murderers. I mean, you don't get out of one of these facilities. It's just a red herring to stir people up.
Dan Proft is our conservative Republican. Dan, nice to have you with us. Contemplating a run for governor of Illinois as a Republican candidate. Nice to have you with us. We'll talk more about that later. What's your answer to what do we do with the detainees?
Well, I mean, first of all, let's remember that the Pentagon issued a report within the last 60 days, so under this administration, that Guantanamo was compliant with the Geneva Convention. So that's number one. So a lot of what's been said about Guantanamo appears to have been rhetoric that didn't match the reality there. That's number one. Number two, the idea of consuming ourselves with concern about what radical Islamists around the globe are going to use as symbols to recruit. If it's not Guantanamo, it's going to be something else. It's going to be the World Trade Towers as it was before, or some other symbol of freedom and capitalism. So I'm not worried about what they think are what they use for symbols as symbols for recruitment or non-recruitment. The Obama administration doesn't know what to do. That's clear, because they're already talking about getting more lead time again to possibly reintroduce military commissions, because they have the same fear now that the reality has set in about extending rights that American citizens would have to some of these detainees.
Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago joins us. Charles, thanks for being with us. Your take on this issue. First of all, $50 million at a time when money, of course, $50 million to the government is like peanuts, but $50 million, is there not a better way to use it?
Well, there are a number of big questions here. I think it's right that it is a recruiting tool, but I think it's also
right. But what about the question that I just asked?
The question about money, I think the money is small potatoes, frankly. I think that because I think that whatever you're going to do with these prisoners is going to cost you at least that much money in other ways. So I don't think that this is a matter of saving a few million here or there. I think that it is a problem as a recruiting tool. It's become a symbol. But I think that the idea that the Obama administration essentially came up with its plan, you shut it down, and then you try to figure out what you're going to do, seems to me to be bass-ackwards.
Can't you just clean it up, Bob? I mean, again, there's a new administration. The administration is trying to project itself to the world that there's a new sheriff in town. Can't they just keep the property? And if the rules have not been violated, or if there's a new person running it, can't you just change the rules and change the name?
I think the administration decided that as an emblem of the break from the horrific record that the Bush administration had in world affairs, that they were going to close Guantanamo and announce it and clearly set a date and then determine how they're going to deal with the problems that presents.
Should they have done it in the reverse order?
I don't think so. I think it was very important for this president when he took office to make it very clear that the policies that are so abhorrent to most people in the world, throughout the world, and have endangered the United States, need to be ended.
I think they've got a problem with that, Bob. First of all, because it's not at all clear that the senior Democrats hadn't signed off on those things. In fact, Nancy Pelosi still can't get her story right. She's come up with three stories so far, and each of them seems to unravel. The reason they put the people at Guantanamo was originally that they thought that they weren't going to be subject to United States laws, that it wouldn't be considered part of the United States territory. I think that we've got a kind of a problem here that we've had with the Treasury Department. That they sort of start off with a big bang, but they don't know where their follow-up is.
Here's the other thing with that, too. Again, the idea that the Obama administration is considering military commissions for trying these folks also runs a counter to a lot of the rhetoric from the left that these folks were being held irresponsibly, that there was innocence at Guantanamo, that we did not have anything to fear from a lot of these people from being on U.S. soil. Not true.
Favor the military commissions?
No, I'm not in favor of the military commissions. I think that the people at Guantanamo either should be dealt with through the judicial system, which has served us very well historically, with terrorists like Tim McVeigh or Massawi or whatever, or they should be turned over to other governments.
So is there going to be opposition?
Other governments won't take them back. Other governments won't take them back.
Speak to Bob's point, and that is there are already maximum security prisons in the United States that people don't break out of. Why not just put them there? There's a new prison, I believe it's in Montana. They wanted them, and then the senators said, no, we don't want them in our backyard.
Well,
it's an empty prison.
Well, there's a couple issues. One is Charles's point, which is if they're tried on U.S. soil, what kind of rights and do they get? Are they going to be conferred rights that a U.S. citizen or a criminal on U.S. soil would get as opposed to an extraterritorial terrorist? I mean, that's a huge issue. Secondarily, the ability to operate networks from prison. We see it with street gangs all the time in this country. This is something significantly more serious.
Back shortly, 1-800-723-8289. There are 240 detainees. They're in Guantanamo. What should we do with them? A member of your Congress is going to be deciding this not too soon. 1-800-723-8289. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. We're talking about what we should do with the 240 detainees in Guantanamo. The administration wants to shut Guantanamo down, so those 240 have got to go someplace. The Attorney General of the United States, Eric Holder, was in Berlin, Germany last week. He was urging European leaders to take their fair share of detainees. He said, I know that Europe did not open Guantanamo and that, in fact, a great many on this continent opposed it. But to close Guantanamo, we must all make sacrifices, and we must all be willing to make unpopular choices. He said the United States is ready to do its part, but he hopes that Europe will do theirs. And also we should mention that of the 241 Guantanamo detainees, 30 of that number have been cleared to be released in the United States. And, Charles, you made the point that there are several varieties of options for these detainees, because many countries of the world, even their originating countries, don't want them back.
That's exactly right. Look, there's several problems here. First, some come from countries where they would be tortured or treated inhumanely, and we're not going to send them back there, or at least we're very reluctant to. So,
is Saudi Arabia one of those countries?
It should be. If it's not, there are no Saudi Arabia is essentially a giant jail anyway for the people who live there. The second thing is that there are a number of other countries where there would be no effective restraint on them. They would immediately, like Yemen, they would immediately reenter the war on terror. And in fact, people released from Guantanamo have done that.
And in China, they would be arrested.
In China, they would be arrested, not given any due process. So we've got a serious problem, because one thing that Bob is right about, I think he's wrong about a number of things, but one thing I think he's right about is that there's a huge PR problem here.
I want to ask a question. Newt Gingrich was on television today. Newt Gingrich, to the recitation of just those points you said, his answer is, why is this our problem? Bob, why is it our problem? We have 241 people that we think are bad guys, whether they've been prosecuted or not. At one point in time, we deemed them as bad guys. So
let's remember, a lot of those people who we deemed as bad guys, it came through Guantanamo, were released by the Bush administration after they subsequently determined, they were brought in by somebody for bounty or whatever.
Let's say that 241 or 210 or whatever the number is that you want to pick that we could agree on. Let's say they are really bad guys. Why is it our responsibility to figure out what happens to them if their countries of origin don't want them back?
If they're really bad guys and we want to do something to either punish or restrain them, then we should use the traditions of America, the judicial system, to do that. That's what we have due process for, to determine if they really are bad guys or are not. The problem that presented itself here is that we used so-called torture or semi-torture in many of these cases that are not admissible as evidence.
Well, we capture German soldiers during World War II. Let's say we capture 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. What do you think is the appropriate?
Well, we abided by the Geneva Conventions. I mean, this was an attempt to avoid the Geneva Conventions.
The difference here that is important for the audience to understand is that the Geneva Convention was designed for use with uniformed soldiers run by states. It was specifically designed to exclude soldiers like al-Qaeda operatives and so forth. So we certainly need to determine, and we may decide that they should be covered by the Geneva Convention, which I believe we now have.
The United States abided by the Geneva Conventions against the Viet Cong, non-uniformed forces in South Vietnam during the Vietnam War. I mean, this is not as unique a circumstance as
right.
the former administration
tries to
make it.
But nobody's saying you don't abide the Geneva Conventions. I think most reasonable people want us to uphold the treaties and the international humanitarian law that we've signed on to.
Well, that was not the case during the Bush administration.
I go back again to the report the Pentagon released during this administration that said Guantanamo Bay was compliant with the Geneva Convention. I know this is an inconvenient fact for Democrats and the left to recognize, but this is a report that was released by Obama's Pentagon.
The big political problem that the Obama administration has is that they can make these appeals to the world, but they're getting no help from the Europeans. Eric Holder's trip, just like Obama's earlier trip, trying to get help for Afghanistan, got nothing. And so we're left with this big problem of what to do. You can go, and we should go, with something like military commissions. We should be able, however, to protect our sources of intelligence. If we have to release our sources of intelligence and the exact ways that people are represented, if we have to give those over to the lawyers for the other side, they will immediately be leaked, and it really is a security problem.
Lamar Smith, Republican of Texas, he has weighed in on this. This is what he had to say. Releasing terrorists endangers American lives both here and abroad. The American people have a right to know how these decisions are are being made. Yet this administration is sharing more information with foreign countries at overseas press conferences than with U.S. members of Congress elected to represent the American people. So my question to you from a political standpoint, let's step back from the morality. Let's step back for every indiscretion or violation that you have identified, Bob. From a political sense, where does this issue come down politically? Is this an issue that a Democratic member of Congress wants to have to address between now and the time they run for re-election, Bob?
Oh, I think the Republicans are trying to stir this up as an issue, this bring people to the United States. When people start thinking about the reality of it, I mean, if there are folks in the United States awaiting trial at high-security prisons, I guarantee they're not running something from the Supermax prison in Littleton, Colorado. It's just not happening. I mean, we have very dangerous people in our prisons. There's no reason these people are any more dangerous than those.
It's a marginal issue unless there's another attack. If there's another attack, then the administration faces the problem that the Bush administration, for all the rightful criticism made of it, protected the United States and that the Obama administration did not. Yeah. So I think that it's a sort of a tempest in a teapot unless there's a real attack.
One thing I want to not let go, the Bush administration did not protect the United States. 9/11 was under Bush on the Bush watch after they were warned by the former administration of al-Qaeda and its problems. They are completely culpable for what happened 9/11.
Please. That's not an outrageous statement. That is an outrageous statement. Warned about al-Qaeda. We were warned about al-Qaeda in 1988. Okay, this idea that one particular administration or one particular president was responsible for the terrorist acts that have been committed against America going back at least 30 years from blowing up the embassy in Lebanon all the way forward. Give me a break to say that George Bush is culpable for 9/11.
Well, he is certainly as culpable as any president. It was on his watch, Dan, and you just can't ignore that.
He received an action memo.
That from the former head of the terrorist czar at the administration said that al-Qaeda was going to run airplanes into buildings, and they did nothing. Now, they like to ignore that, but the 9/11 Commission was very clear about it, and so you can't say they protected America. That's the point I want to get at. They did not protect America. They made us less safe around the world. Help recruit with all of these.
So if they were culpable for 9/11, so then they get credit for the ensuing 7 years where there were no terrorist attacks in American soil. Is that your position?
My position is that it is impossible to protect American soil entirely from terrorist attacks. It is possible.
It's impossible.
It is possible to create an environment where large numbers of people are not driven into the terrorist arms by the kind of policies that were adopted by the Bush administration.
Let's go back to the first terrorist attack on the United States, and that was in 1993 under the Clinton administration, the World Trade Center.
That was because they anticipated the Bush administration.
Why did we not learn from that? Why did those with all the power at that point not respond in a more affirmative way that maybe would have kept the second attack from happening? I mean, if you're going to go back and say this happened here, I mean, don't you really have to go back to 1993? And as Danny acknowledged with the Republican administration, don't you have to go back to what happened under the Reagan administration when we responded very weakly and hightailed it out of Lebanon after Marines were murdered?
All of these things play a role. I don't doubt that.
I know, but the real question is, you singled in on Bush being responsible.
Basically, I wanted to make clear that the notion that this previous administration, so-called, protected the United States from terrorist attacks is simply not true.
They have protected the United States since the 9/11 attacks.
Well, have not been additional attacks since 9/11. They have created a circumstance where there are more people in the world who hate us and are potential recruits for terrorist organizations by dint of their activities.
When things go wrong, it's their fault. When things go right, it's not to their credit.
I think the big issue is whether or not the Obama administration goes back to the failed policies of the Clinton administration of treating the whole matter as a law enforcement issue. And we really don't know. And I think the president himself may not know. And his national security team may not know. But there have been a number of disturbing elements about the foreign policy of this administration. For example, their treatment of Iran has been extremely weak.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Lots of callers on the line. We'll bring them into the talk and discussion when we come back from Chicago. From Bakersfield, California to Boardman, Ohio, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. Before we reintroduce our guests, let me remind you that this coming Saturday night, the 16th of May, there's a big benefit for the Museum of Broadcast Communications. It is a farewell salute to Warner Saunders, retiring after 40 years in Chicago broadcasting. It's May 16th at the Fairmont Hotel. If you'd like to order tickets, museum.tv. www.museum.tv. And also, if you'd like to take a chance on a raffle prize, a trip for two, all expenses paid, to Hollywood, California. Raffle tickets, $50 a piece. Again, museum.tv. You can help the museum, a worthy cause, and again, say a farewell to a great broadcaster. And we appreciate Warner making himself available. He's been not feeling well lately, but again, he'll be there next Saturday night at the Fairmont Hotel. Joining us now to share their thoughts and opinions, let me reintroduce our guests. Our Liberal Democrat tonight is Bob Cramer. He is author of the book called Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. And it says, listen to your mother before that. Bob, you've been a political advisor to Jan Schakowsky, who is your wife.
Indeed.
A veteran, liberal Democrat, a member of Congress. And she is contemplating a step up and running in the Democratic primary for the United States Senate next year. What can you tell us about the thought process that's going through the home?
Well, she's going to make an announcement June 8th. We've decided she's going to make a decision and an announcement, and I can't really tell you the day-to-day. It's a little of this or a little of that. I mean, she certainly feels that what she's doing now is enormously important. I mean, she's not looking to do something that gives up that seat if she can help it. On the other hand, stepping up to the Senate is quite an important step as well.
What is it that she could do in the Senate that she cannot do in the House, given her rather high position in the House at the moment and very close friendship with Speaker Pelosi?
And with the president. She's contemplating that, exactly. Is it worth spending the next year and a half raising a lot of money and campaigning and diverting her energy from this 2 years, which is so important in Washington? I mean, a lot of us worked for this time for a long, long time. So that's a question. And members of the Senate have a lot of power and probably more power than most members of the House in any circumstance to affect change.
And just between the four of us, what are you advising her to do?
I feel exactly as she does. And that is that, there are good reasons to, and there are good reasons not to. And in the end, she's going to have to make her own judgment and have a gut check and figure out exactly what she wants to do.
Well, we hope to have her here on Beyond the Beltway, where she can let us know what she's going to do.
Okay.
I've been a guest on this program for many times.
Okay.
Also joining us this evening is Dan Proft, a veteran of this program. He's been on this program for over 10 years, believe it or not, Dan.
Wow.
And also a commentator for WLS Radio. And again, for those listening around the country, Dan Proft is currently contemplating a run for the Republican nomination for governor of Illinois. So tell us about your decision-making process.
Are you going to do the Connie Chung with me, too, just kind of whisper in your ear?
Tell us, what's going to happen here?
I'm thinking about it. I am thinking about it. The Illinois Republican Party over the last decade has been the bad example nationally in terms of what you do if you want to lose elections. And so really the impetus for this is the need for the party to kind of turn the page in Illinois and usher in a new generation of leadership and be a party of ideas again in this state, as we need to do nationally. And so I'm giving serious thought to taking on the Chicago machine that runs this state and seeing if people in Illinois are fed up enough with what has been wrought under the rule of Chicago Democrats here and that they're ready for different kind of change.
Do you think that the Republican Party over the last 10 to 15 years in Illinois has cozied up to the Cook County leadership under Mayor Daley, and that basically they're two peas in the pod?
Well, I mean, I think there's certainly that's been part of the problem, is that there has not been a clear and consistent contrasting vision presented in terms of what the brand Illinois Republican Party means. What's the promise implicit in that label? I think there have been Republicans who have settled for table scraps from Chicago Democrats, and that's why we find ourselves in such a decided minority with Chicago Democrats running the show in Illinois, and it's been incredibly to Illinois' detriment. I mean, if it wasn't for Ohio and Michigan, Illinois would be in the worst economic shape of any other state in this nation.
Do you believe that the future of the party, both in Illinois and even nationally, is the way to electoral victories, in your view? Is it expanding the base and making the tent larger, or is it going back and like a laser beam going back into some of the core principles that have been associated with the party over the years?
Well, I mean, I don't know that those two choices are mutually exclusive. I think what the party needs to do is reestablish its brand values, reestablish its core principles, and make sure that people understand what those are, and then articulate policies that flow from those principles that are relevant to people's lives today. In other words, you can't just recite bromides from the 1980s and recall Ronald Reagan. You have to do what Reagan did, which was speak with moral clarity on the salient issues of the day that impact people's lives, and what you're going to do in 2009 and 10 on education reform, on access to health care, on creating a more positive job-creating business climate. I mean, I think that's really where the Republican Party needs to go. It's not specific demographics. We don't play race and gender politics. That's what the left does. It's a psychographic. It's what's between people's ears, not what their skin color is or what their gender is.
Charles Lipson also joins us. Now, Charles, you were running for nothing. You're contemplating no run for political office. Is that
I'm
correct?
I'm trying to raise money for my rent.
Okay, well, that's good. And you do that by selling your book, not on street corners, but it's called Doing Honest Work in College, How to Prepare Citations, Avoid Plagiarism, and Achieve Real Academic Success. And again, a longtime member of the Political Science Department at the University of Chicago, and as we always say, a pride of Marks, Mississippi. We have a full board of lights returning to them right now. Larry in Fort Wayne, Indiana, is listening to us on WoWo. Nice to hear from Eastern Indiana tonight. Go ahead.
I was just getting this question out, and I'll hang up. If they do end up back in the United States and end up in one of these supermax prisons, I'm just wondering, will they be suing because they're not getting the proper diets that their religion requires, or being able to pray as they need to? And if they do, supermax, I understand you're locked up for 23 hours a day. I don't know. But if that's the case, is that cruel and unusual? I just see a lot of questions down the line.
They would receive... You're asking good questions, but the point is, if they're tried by a military commission or tried by a U.S. court, they would receive the standard and humane treatment that they should. If they won't eat pork products, they shouldn't be fed a diet of pork cutlets. If they need time to pray each day, they should have the time to pray each day. That's what we as Americans do. And so I think that the issue is not whether we give them those kinds of rights. We should. I think the real issue is that we should do that in ways that are consistent with keeping secret the way we collect intelligence, and not releasing people who are really bad guys back out into the world to do these things against us. And I agree with Bob on one more issue, which is we should be very cautious about doing things that make recruitment easier. The thing that was wrong with the Bush administration's strategy in Iraq until General Petraeus came in was you just try to kill the bad guys. And what's wrong with that is not that it's a bad thing to kill the bad guys. It's a good thing to kill the bad guys. The problem is if two new bad guys crop up for every one you kill, then you hadn't solved the problem.
Yeah,
you need
to marginalize the enemy. I mean, you're never going to fully eliminate. You can't kill your way to a political objective. I agree with that. But it's an important distinction between military commissions and U.S.
civilian
courts,
yeah,
because the rules of evidence are significantly different. And that's what people need to understand in terms of the very point you're talking to, Charles,
right,
which is the idea of secrets that would get out that would compromise national security.
And what is your view on the military commissions, Bob?
I think that the military commissions in general are a terrible idea because they say to the world, we're not willing to use the same standards of due process to deal with the charges in question here that we hold up as our values. We want to have star chambers for people. Well, that's not appropriate.
Ann in Southern Illinois listening to us on WLS, our flagship station. Go ahead, Ann.
Good afternoon. I'm going to pull over here because I'm traveling.
Please do.
I've been listening for a while, and it's Mother's Day, so I'm going to call.
Happy Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day to you.
Indeed. Yeah, thank you. All the bickering that goes on with regard to this bipartisan arguing and politicizing, I tell you, both of you guys, you lose all American voters on that kind of stuff. Getting to the issue of Guantanamo Bay, keep it open. It has its purpose. It served its purpose well. And we have gone so far with the politically correct garbage that it's ridiculous. Now, if you have to close Guantanamo Bay, put everybody in Alcatraz, put all that money into Alcatraz, reopen it, fund it that way, but they get no American rights. They're not Americans. Thank you.
Bob, your response.
I mean, I appreciate people's concerns about national security. But the thing that we can do to make ourselves secure more than any other is to stand up for the values that we espouse in the world and not to present ourselves in a situation that makes us appear to be hypocrites to most of the rest of the world.
I want to follow up on that when we come back. 1-800-723-8029. More calls when we come back from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. I want to follow up on this caller's suggestion, Alcatraz. What about opening up Alcatraz?
I just don't know that that's necessary. Most of these people will be disposed or dealt with through either the judicial system or through other countries. There'll be a small number that have to be taken to the United States for some kind of detention until judicial review is undertaken.
Well, putting them in San Francisco is attractive in its own right. But I think what we've got to do
put them in
is
Detroit would be better. Detroit needs more economic development.
Exactly.
John Conyers can watch them, can watch over them.
This is a small number of people. We've got enough high security prisons.
Plenty.
And apparently Congressman Moran, or maybe it's pronounced Moron, of Virginia wants them in his district. I don't know what he's thinking.
We'll see. But
I think this is a red herring issue. Fundamentally,
I want to go back to the core issue of your point: is that it is that Guantanamo has a bad image, and that it is the American values and American image that is the principal reason why you want to close Guantanamo.
I think that is extremely important for the future safety of the United States, and by the way, it's not just Guantanamo. It was ending torture. It was ending extraordinary rendition, sending people to be tortured in other countries.
But what I'm saying is one of the other things, though, is that we had an election. We have a new president.
Yep.
If the new president goes on worldwide television or when he goes to Cairo on June 4th to speak to the Muslim world, if he explains to them that there's a new day in Guantanamo – what's wrong with the building? What's wrong with the buildings at Guantanamo? It was the policy that he didn't like. If he's the president and is changing the policy, what's magical about just keeping them there? He can give them whatever rights he wants. He can tribunals. He can do whatever he wants. But what is so wrong about keeping 241 people in a place where they've been for the last 7 or 8 years?
Guantanamo is iconic to the world.
I think that it's important to remember. I mean, what Bob is saying about changing our profile in the world is important, but it's not a magic bullet. And it's important to remember, as Dan said earlier, that in 1993, There was an attack on the World Trade Center, and it would have knocked them down if they had been capable of doing it. And that occurred during a different administration. It
Sure.
occurred when none of these things had happened. And so it's really – we are overestimating the way in which the nuances of our policy affect things. I think it will help, but I don't think it's
help,
anything
help.
Close.
I've got to take a call. Sam in Chicago on WLS and Coast to Coast, you're on the air.
Yeah, well, Bruce, I absolutely disagree with Mr. Kramer. I think the message to anyone who wants to engage in flying airplanes into buildings and incinerating 3,000 citizens or future acts to poison us, burn us up, do any of those things is that when we capture you on the battlefield, you're going to be tortured and we're going to find out what you know. And, Mr. Kramer, I'd like to ask you this question. If you believe that due process should be accorded to anyone who's captured before we prosecute them, does that extend to the fact that we should court due process before a predator fires a rocket at somebody who's in western Pakistan who we believe to be a terrorist? Should there be a full-blown hearing? We'll have adversarial process before that rocket could be fired? Because obviously that's the death penalty.
You know, there are very clear procedures on the Geneva Conventions to dealing with prisoners of war.
I'm asking you that question. And that's why should it be any different because we capture them? Why shouldn't there be due process extended to somebody who is absolutely operating in their country before we file a predator rocket?
I have no problem with people being treated under the Geneva Conventions according to international law. That's
no,
the other
should
option.
Should we have a hearing before we use the death penalty on a suspected terrorist in western Pakistan, if you're advocating that we should have a
Let me try answering part of this question. It's a different thing to fire missiles at people than dealing with them once you're captured. But
right.
we should have very clear procedures about what to do in advance if we know that if we are confident that there are innocents in those houses. That's an issue that the Israeli army has dealt with and others have dealt with. You have to know what to do.
Rules of engagement.
Dan
Rules of engagement.
In Nashville on WNOX, you're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen.
Yes, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I guess this kind of dovetails nicely off the last gentleman's call. And my question is tied to the value system that you, Mr. Kramer, continue to espouse. But when I look at the party that you come from and I see your value system and the embrace of homosexuals and the embrace of infanticide and the embrace of keeping our black brothers and sisters held down under government oppression and welfare, I wonder, what is these values that you speak of? I mean, is it to be held in high esteem in European capital?
Let's let him respond. You gave him a lot to talk about, and you got 30 seconds to answer.
Okay, well,
all three of you hit it.
Okay.
Obviously, we have a different worldview on a number of these questions. But progressive values, the traditional progressive values of the United States, due process, that everyone's created equal, that everyone should have an equal opportunity to excel, those are the values that this country has always stood for. And I'm suggesting that we have to make sure that in a time of national insecurity, we don't fall into a circumstance where we ignore them.
Bob Kramer, he is our liberal in hour number one. Bob, thank you very much for being with us. Charles Lipson from the University of Chicago has also joined us. We thank you very much. Dan Proft is our conservative Republican. Dan and Bob, they will be back in our next hour. If you're listening to this program on radio, and we're going to be joined by Brian Jennings. He's written a new book on censorship. He fears that there's going to be a return of the fairness doctrine, and a lot of people on talk radio are very upset about it. We'll give you an opportunity to weigh in on that issue as well. 1-800-723-8029. If you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. If you're listening to us on radio, stay right where you are. Another full hour of Beyond the Beltway coming to you from Chicago in about 6 minutes. Can you be specific? I mean, what are the words that keep a conservative off of a local advisory council?
Well, I'll give you an example. The Minority Media Telecommunications Council has suggested in its report for the FCC that it would not do to have an advertiser on that board from a radio station. One of the advertisers that drives the economic engine of a community would not have a say in the programming of that radio station. It's just an incredible leap into liberalism. And the other thing is the FCC doesn't know whether these boards would be appointed or whether they even use the word elected at one point. It's just an incredible censorship issue in America.
Now, once upon a time, again, before the Fairness Doctrine was thrown out, and it was, by the way, was thrown out during the Reagan administration, and again, there had been some questionable decisions, leading up to it. But basically, most people felt that its time had come, and also most people felt at that time, and as some do now, that it really wouldn't pass the constitutionality test if it really got pushed to the highest levels of the court. But there used to be a thing called ascertainment. And before a station could get a license, be relicensed, they would have to go out and talk with community leaders to find out what was going on in their community. And then that would hopefully reflect itself in the programming. What's wrong with that concept of going out and talking to people within the community to determine what programming goes on your station, Brian?
There is absolutely nothing wrong with it, and American radio stations still do it, but they do it on a voluntary basis. And I'll tell you this, if you're a free market concept person, if you believe in the free market, radio stations already have their board of advisors. It's called listeners. And if there are no listeners to a radio station, that is your advisory to get rid of that programming and to do something else that appeals to people. This is an area that really is all about a listener's desire to hear what they want to hear when they want to hear it, as much as it is my ability to speak freely on the radio.
Brian, let me ask you this. It's Bob Creamer. It sounds to me that what we're doing here is creating kind of a sense of victimhood on behalf of the right-wing radio community against a straw man that's really not happening. The only thing I can wonder is, I mean, what is your position on making sure we don't have concentrations of media ownership, that we have a diffuse ownership of the media, that there are limits on what you can do in one particular market and that sort of thing? Because, it's fine to say listeners can listen to whatever they want, but if only one thing is being offered by one set of vendors, then they got a problem, no?
No, they don't have a problem. You have hundreds of urban hosts around the nation who are liberal. You have NPR. You have virtually every media in your side pocket, the New York Times, the Washington Post, all the cable networks. You guys have the liberal media. Even studies have shown that liberals think the media is liberal.
But Brian, are you against concentration of ownership rules to prevent concentration of ownership? That's my question. I think that's people around America just rose up when there were proposals to eliminate or limit those limits on concentration of ownership, both right and left across America.
I don't think there's a concentration of talk radio. That's what I'm talking about. Yes, there is a concentration of ownership, but when you consider talk radio in America, it's very small compared to the overall media ownership out there and the media concentration, which is dominated by liberals.
So you don't have any objection. So you don't have any objection to the FCC rules that would limit media ownership concentration?
I do.
You do? Why? I understand why that would be the case.
Because you take a license away from somebody, give it to another person in a free marketplace, that is dictatorial, that is tyrannical, and that is censorship.
So, Brian, you wouldn't care. You wouldn't care if a couple of big conglomerates bought up all the major media outlets in a particular market. Is that right?
They don't have all the media ownership.
I'm asking, the FCC rules prohibit a concentration of ownership by one or one large conglomerate or company.
It's impossible for them to do it now anyway. That's a moot point.
So you're in favor of that restriction, is that right? or no?
I am in favor of the free marketplace allowing people to hear what they want to hear and for radio broadcasters to speak the way they want to speak.
Well, so am I. I just want to make sure there are plenty of different outlets available.
There are plenty of different outlets available.
There are plenty of different outlets available, my friend. You've got every liberal media out there and all the cables. Conservative talk radio is a very small portion of the media mix altogether, guys.
I told you, I'm happy to have
that. That's right. Look, the mainstream media is monolithic in their attitude, right, in their philosophy to the extent it's discernible. So I would be much more worried about concentration of opinion, of an orthodoxy that pervades the old media. There is diffuseness with media now because of the Internet and because of all of the incarnations of the web now.
I don't disagree with
you. Right, but these are not straw man arguments. Cass Sunstein is not a straw man. He's an actual human being.
That's
he
right.
really exists, as shocking as that is. I'm not making him up. He exists. Mr. Jennings referred to as some of the remarks that have been made by Nancy Pelosi and others, those are actual human beings making actual statements. I know it's surprising. I can't believe it either, Bob, but they're making those statements. Let me tell you something else. Let me say one more thing. This, to me, this whole fairness doctrine stuff, this is a classic leftism. It's the same thing that started happening on college campuses in the 80s with the incursion against academic freedom. The left doesn't want to have arguments. They don't want to participate in arguments. They want arguments to never occur. Mark Stein has written about this, and others have too. They don't want to have their authority questioned. They are not interested in arguments. They are interested in central command control, a top-down propaganda machine, which is what we're being, which is what's inflicted upon us by this administration.
Brian, your response. Go ahead.
They want media to be absolutely compliant. Just look at the news conferences right now. That's just an absolutely pathetic thing going on in America. The only medium asking hard questions right now is conservative talk radio. The left knows it, and they're willing to get rid of it. They absolutely are. This is an argument about taking down conservative values. And they know they can do it by taking down conservative talk radio.
Look what happened.
Brian, early on, I mean, Bob Kramer just says he likes Rush Limbaugh. He thinks Rush Limbaugh is a recruiter for his side.
Absolutely. I would love you guys. The more you talk, the better.
Well, then, Bob, you should talk to all your folks in leadership position in Congress, and you should talk to Paul Begala and all these other talking heads on the cable stations. I mean, look what their reaction was to the Tea Parties. They were lighting their hair on fire. This has to be stopped. These people are anti-American. They don't love their country.
What Begala said.
They saw that, and they are frightened by it. They don't want to listen to it. They don't want to hear those arguments, so that's why they're propagating things like the fairness doctrine.
You can't, on the one hand, say that people shouldn't have a spirited debate, and then say when progressives call these things for what they were, and that it was sponsored events by Fox News,
people who don't love their country,
that was unfortunate. I mean, you've got to allow a complete debate. You know, we had a big debate in this country for the last 4 years. The progressive side won in the last election.
What's the problem? Why regulate radio?
I think you're creating a straw man just to whip up concern. And that has been a story for the right for years in the United
America
States.
Is what you're doing. Get rid of localism in America. Get rid of the inane idea of programming advisory boards for radio stations. My goodness, what kind of a czar is that?
If we're whipping this up, then who are these people? Nancy Pelosi is not saying these things?
The real question has to do with media ownership and its concentration.
No, there's not a concentration of media ownership. You said this is a straw man.
1-800-723-8228. Brian, can you stick with us a little bit longer?
I can.
Good, because you've riled everybody up. We've got the phones ringing. We're going to hear from them when we come back. 1-800-723-8289. From coast to coast and border to border, every Sunday night on America's great radio stations and Sirius and XM satellite radio, I'm Bruce Dumont.
I can't stop scratching. My scalp's so itchy and dry.
That's your clue. It could be your shampoo. Finally, two new Celsin Blue shampoos just for itchy dry scalp due to dandruff. Celsin Blue Itchy Dry Scalp has a strong itch fighter plus 5 hydrating moisturizers. And Celsin Blue Naturals Itchy Dry Scalp adds 8 intensive moisturizers and botanicals. Both stop the itch and leave hair healthy.
Smells great, too.
Got a clue? Get the blue. New Celsin Blue Itchy Dry Scalp shampoos. Use as directed.
Hotels.com gives you a free night for every 10 nights you book. You can book 10 nights in Tulsa to get one free night in San Fran, or book 7 nights in Providence and 3 nights in Richmond to get one free night in Reno. But a combination you definitely can't do is 2 nights in Grated Cheesetown and 8 nights in Roller Rinkerton to get one free night in Rabbit Stewville. Because, unfortunately, none of those places exist. Get free nights with welcome rewards from Hotels.com. Join online or call 800-2-HOTELS.
Some exclusions and restrictions apply. See site for details.
From San Diego, California to Fayetteville, North Carolina, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8289. The title of the book is Censorship, The Threat to Silence Talk Radio, The New Fairness Doctrine Exposed. Brian Jennings is the author, and he is our guest, forward by Sean Hannity. And in the studio with us, we have Bob Creamer, who's one of the leading progressive thinkers in the Chicagoland area. He is the husband of Jan Schakowsky, one of the more liberal members of the United States House of Representatives. Dan Proft also joins us. He is a political commentator for WLS Radio, and he is contemplating a run for the Republican nomination for governor of Illinois. He'll tell us his answer in a few weeks. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Marvin, listening to us in Austin, Texas. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say I keep hearing people talk about the liberal media, and I'll admit I don't listen to TV. I drive and I listen to the radio. The media I hear is not liberal. And if the media were really liberal, it seems to me that the conservatives would be wanting the fairness doctrine.
Right. The difference is conservatives believe in markets, and they believe in people's opinions driving what's on the air, not in top-down government bureaucrats deciding what you can and cannot hear. So that's the difference. Right. You're exactly right. No conservative. That is actually an excellent point you make implicit in the question, which is conservatives are not advocating the fairness doctrine. They're not advocating taking Keith Olbermann off the air or having Dan Proft sit next to Keith Olbermann to go point counterpoint. We're not advocating that.
I don't think anybody's
advocating. Make your arguments.
But they are advocating a monopoly. So, you know, I don't see if there was the liberal media, it looks like they
would be looking for a but generally, I would say that going back to this started in about 1964. The American people's perception that the national media, particularly the network news operations, were left of center goes back basically to 1964. And that was the coverage of the Barry Goldwater campaign, which if it was at a prize fight, a referee would have stopped it. It was so unfair. And that's where I believe that conservative Republicans and conservatives began to believe that. It became, frankly, a device in which conservative Republicans could raise political funds. Yep. They've used it since 1964. And in 1968, something else happened. And it happened right here in the city of Chicago. There were millions, tens of millions of Americans watching the television on August 28th of 1968, and they saw a riot in Chicago outside the Democratic Convention and outside the Conrad Hilton Hotel. They saw demonstrators, many of whom they did not like, being treated in a rough manner by the Chicago Police Department. The news media immediately gravitated to painting the Chicago police as the bad guys, and that story was parroted by all of the network news commentators. The person that stood up against it at that point happened to be the mayor of the city of Chicago, Richard J. Daley. The news media then vilified him. And what happened that night, that was the beginning of the real break between the American people and network news. Because the people who were out there in television land, they saw those pictures completely different than the news people who were talking about it on the air. Completely different. And I believe that ever since that time, there have been more and more demonstrations when network television covers a story. It is generally a left-of-center slant, virtually always.
But Bruce, there's one thing. There's actually empirical data, right? The exit polling done every election about who journalists vote for. And usually it's at a 75 or higher percent clip that they vote for the Democrat nominee for president. So this is not something conjured up by conservative Republicans.
Guys, look, if anybody could argue that the media did not roll over and play dead when it came to the Iraq war and the policies of this last administration for the first 4, 6, 7, 6 years of the administration. I mean, There was,
as did Democratic members of Congress.
Not all Democratic members of Congress.
The majority.
Actually, you know what? 60% of the members of the House voted against the bill to authorize the war in Iraq. So a little-known fact. But beyond that, look, the issue here is not whether people want free speech. We really want free speech from a progressive point of view. We want to make sure that there are multiple voices in the marketplace, because we are convinced that once there are multiple voices, we win the debate. And the last election certainly does tend to give us that.
I want to ask you a question, then I want Brian to respond to it. In your view, do you believe can you understand why conservatives believe that television news and television in general is left of center? Can you understand why conservatives believe that?
I think there has been a narrative developed by the far right and by talk radio in particular to convince people that that is true, and that has rung true to many of the people who are particularly appealing or are appealed to by the notion that small-town values are under attack, that it's Hollywood, that it's the professionals, that it's the class war they talk about is a class war between the media people and the Hollywood gang.
I
understand that.
Brian, I'm going to let you tackle that first, because you've touched a real nerve here, and then Dan's chopping to bite as well. Go ahead, Brian.
There have been numerous studies since 1965 which show that 80% of White House correspondents, of network news correspondents, are Democrat. The New York Post, the Washington Post is definitely liberal-leaning. Even the ombudswoman for the Washington Post this past election admitted in her own newspaper that newspaper favored Barack Obama in its coverage, that its coverage was skewed. There are numerous studies done by the Pew Research Center showing the same thing, the Media Research Center. The media is predominantly liberal because the journalism schools are predominantly liberal, as our colleges are.
You know,
goes back to that root.
In Washington, D.C., the Washington Post competes every day with the Washington Times, owned by people who are right of center. And there are two media available to everyone.
Yeah, but the point is that the vast swath of the old media is liberal. The empirical evidence is there. We see examples every day. I mean, last night at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, right? I'm glad Mr. Jennings brought this up, talking about White House correspondents. The White House Correspondents' Dinner, Wanda Sykes says Rush Limbaugh was the 20th hijacker. 9/11, and the entire room erupts with laughter. Well, guess what? They might be laughing because they're elitist jerks. The rest of the country sees that stuff and they're not laughing. They think it's over the top, and the rest of the country is right. The elitist jerks in the Washington Press Corps are not.
Brian, you make a point that it isn't just news. You talk about even entertainment. You talk about the affection that you and your wife have for the TV series Boston Legal, but you think it went over the line on election eve.
Well, it did for us. We loved the program, but it did for us because they came out squarely for Obama. And everybody has a right to free speech, and I'm not going to quell their right to free speech either, but it just serves as an example as to why conservative talk radio is needed in America, and there should be no regulations on speech through the FCC in America. Government has no right to regulate content, and these measures, localism and diversity, are exactly content regulation measures.
Let's go to Leroy, listening to us in Wilmington, North Carolina, on WAAV. Go ahead, Wilmington.
Yeah.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Do what?
You're on the air, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm just calling about your cutting out the freedom of radios, and then next is freedom of speech, which all runs together in the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about the Democrats. Well, there are no more Democrats. Why don't we call it like it is? The Democrats are nothing but the communists now, and the Republicans are 90% liberal. So I don't know where y'all are coming up with conservatives at.
There's very 90% of the Republicans
around.
Are liberals,
well,
Dan?
When
wow.
Jesse Helms died, that was the last of the conservatives.
The last of the conservatives. Let's go to Betsy in Youngstown, Ohio on WKBN. Betsy, are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can. Go ahead.
I'm a local talk show listener. I listen in the morning. I listen in the afternoon. I listen on the weekends. And WKBN is a great station, but they play Rush Limbaugh and Michael Savage 24/7. I listen to Air America, other liberal stations, and I get a totally new twist on the news. I get actual information. I get stuff that's happening. And I'm just tired of all the name-calling that goes on with all these conservative talk shows. I think it's appalling with the name-calling. And that's my basic problem with Rush Limbaugh and Michael Savage, for instance. They're the only people we can listen to in Youngstown, and no matter how much we protest, they won't do a thing about it because Clear Channel runs WKBN, and they're conservative, and we're stuck.
And that's the fundamental issue. I mean, if you want freedom of speech, you have to have a multiplicity of voices, and that means you shouldn't have concentrated ownership like Clear Channel prescribing what people listen to.
You're stuck because Rush and Michael Savage and others make money for the station. So you might or individuals might not like what a particular station offers. Then listen online. Listen to Blog Talk Radio.
But also on WKBN,
I mean,
you've got.
But
Betsy,
WKBN,
you've got Ron. You,
I personally boycott every single company that advertises during the Rush Limbaugh show.
Betsy, in Youngstown, Ohio, you also have one of the most articulate progressive talk show hosts in the country, Ron Verb. Do you listen to Ron in the evening?
Yes, I do listen to Ron.
Okay, well, then the progressive view is well articulated 5 days a week on WKBN in Youngstown. I'm Bruce Dumont, 1-800-723-8029. Brian Jennings, can you stick with us a little bit longer?
A little bit longer.
More calls at 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont.
I can't stop scratching. My scalp's so itchy and dry.
That's your clue. It could be your shampoo. Finally, two new Celsin Blue shampoos just for itchy dry scalp due to dandruff. Celsin Blue Itchy Dry Scalp has a strong itch fighter plus 5 hydrating moisturizers. And Celsin Blue Naturals Itchy Dry Scalp adds 8 intensive moisturizers and botanicals. Both stop the itch and leave hair healthy.
Smells great, too.
Got a clue? Get the blue. New Celsin Blue Itchy Dry Scalp shampoos. Use as directed.
Hotels.com gives you a free night for every 10 nights you book. You can book 10 nights in Tulsa to get one free night in San Fran, or book 7 nights in Providence and 3 nights in Richmond to get one free night in Reno. But a combination you definitely can't do is 2 nights in Grated Cheesetown and 8 nights in Roller Rinkerton to get one free night in Rabbit Stewville. Because, unfortunately, none of those places exist. Get free nights with welcome rewards from Hotels.com. Join online or call 800-2-HOTELS.
Some exclusions and restrictions apply. See site for details.
From Sioux Falls, South Dakota to Tallahassee, Florida, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8029. Let's go to Jim in South Elgin. Listening to us on our flagship station, WLS, the radio home of Don Wade and Roma, every morning. Go ahead.
And following this show, great Tom Roser show.
You're
anyways,
right.
It's
the irrepressible Tom Roser.
That's right. He's a great guy. Bob, is it your name? You're showing why Democrats and liberals are afraid of competition because, you know, I'll give you an example. Here in Chicago, there's another AM radio station that started up a liberal talk show, WVON. And I call in quite a bit as a conservative caller. Those people are nice, respectful. I've formed some nice relationships personally with a few of the people that work there, some of the hosts and things. And I call in all the time, and they don't agree with me sometimes, but they listen and they're polite. So as a result, I tell a lot of my friends, you know, if you want to listen to what, you know, the liberal people think about and talk about, you call in and they treat you like $1 million. And guess what? Their audience grows because they're not cherry-picking who's calling in. And this is an example of the free market at work. And when you do things like this localism, free market, you're exactly stifling the very thing that made, for example, WVN prosper and do what it's doing well.
Yeah, I'm not for doing that. I'm for having lots of different voices. I think the debate is absolutely desirable. In fact, as I said earlier, I mean, we've been kind of promoting Rush Limbaugh as a major spokesman for the Republican Party because he, frankly, the more people listen to him, the more they become progressive Democrats. But the media concentration issue is a different matter. You got to make sure those voices are out there, and I think that's the key question here.
And
well,
I think
when
that's...
you talk about concentration, you're talking, like Dan says, against the free market. I'm sorry.
No, the free market is...
You're not being honest.
Hold on. Free market, by definition, is multiple players, not monopoly.
Right,
and that's all we're talking about.
Yeah, but you want to artificially decide who can own how much.
That's not
the market.
No, I just want to prevent somebody from concentrating their ownership so much.
Brian
that
Jennings,
only people in the market are the one.
I want to bring Brian Jennings back into the conversation. Brian is author of the book Censorship. Next Thursday, the 31-member advisory committee on diversity for communications in the digital age. This is an advisory committee to the Federal Communications Commission, which controls American broadcasting. They are going to be meeting, and there has been some question about the diversity of the diversity panel. Where do you come down on that, Brian?
Well, I think it is definitely stacked toward liberalism. I've looked over the list. I can't say for 100% sure, but you know what? I can identify some of the liberals on it. And I would hope that Mr. Copps would realize that conservative talk voices should be heard. For instance, why isn't Clear Channel on that board? Why isn't Citadel Broadcasting on that board? Why isn't Sean Hannity on that board? Obvious reasons, they don't want that viewpoint on the board. They want to go a different direction.
All right, there's your answer. Let's go to Robert in Chicago, listening to us on channel on WLS. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. You know, the point I wanted to make, I mean, I'm kind of surprised by the argument that you guys are having. All you have to do is turn the television on today, and you have guys telling you about the warm, tingly feeling they have coming up their leg when Barack Obama speaks. You don't see anything on television, really, except for Fox News that goes right or that's for conservatism.
I'll tell you what, and here's the other thing that I like to point out to my my liberal friends, too, who like to complain about Fox News. Fox News, as distinguished from the other networks, doesn't hide their point of view. I mean, Fox News says we're right of center. No, nobody is unclear where Sean Hannity is coming from. It is the disingenuousness of the mainstream media and some of these other networks that they present a patina of objectivity. They pretend to be journalists.
Not MSNBC.
Well, maybe not
no,
MSNBC.
Not at all.
But they pretend to be journalists who have no opinion and no axe to grind, and they all do. They all do, and it's very clear. And again, from all the empirical evidence that Mr. Jennings referred to and I referred to earlier, it's clear the point of view. So be honest about the point of view, much like the British tabloids are. You know which is the Whig paper, you know which is the Tory paper, and then let people make up their own minds about who has the more compelling arguments.
Well, and that's the case in Washington, D.C. There is a more liberal paper.
Right.
By the way, not extremely. And then there's a fairly conservative paper, and people make up their mind. That's a good thing.
Let's go to Ben in Knoxville on WNOX. Let's go, the blowtorch of the South. Nice to hear from you. Ben,
hey.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you guys hear me?
Sure, you can. We can all over the country. They're listening to you.
All right. I think my main argument is that, yeah, the free market, I think the biggest example of that is the Internet. And I think most media outlets are actually scared of the Internet, and I've got a prime example. You know, about a month ago, that whole Susan Boyle thing on the, you guys know what I'm talking about?
Yes, yeah,
Britain's Got Talent.
Yeah, Britain's Got Talent,
well,
right.
I mean, that scared a lot of people in Hollywood and stuff, that all of a sudden somebody can be discovered overnight through Twitter and YouTube. I think that the media is going into the hands of the people, and your argument is exactly for that, although you're not talking about it.
Say, I am entirely in favor of completely free Internet. I will say this, though. I mean, the biggest problem, I think, frankly, is that facing the media in the United States and our availability for media is not this thing that Brian's talking about. It's the destruction of major newspapers and the way we pay for journalists, which is going to be a big problem. And I'm not sure how to solve it.
Well,
it's a problem.
They've destroyed themselves.
Well, that could be.
Yeah. Well, also, it's, you know, from a political standpoint, it is the one slice that many liberals believe they don't have complete control over. I'm talking about talk radio. Mm-hmm. And talk radio has demonstrated for the last several election cycles that they can be very influential. They weren't very influential last time because I didn't think they wanted Obama to be elected. So they're not always influential, but they're one of the few things in the Republican or conservative arsenal from a media perspective that's out there. And I think that it has caused concern to some Democrats. But you're not worried about it, Bob?
No, just the opposite.
We just need to get Bob to convince his friends, that's all.
Brian Jennings, we thank you very much for joining us tonight. Nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway.
Speak freely, guys.
The title of the book is Censorship, The Threat to Silence Talk Radio, A New Fairness Doctrine Exposed, now available at all major bookstores, forward by Sean Hannity. Our thanks to Bob Cramer, who's been our Liberal Democrat tonight. Dan Prof, thank you very much. We want to talk more about your run for governor when we come back. I'm Bruce Dumont. This program is produced by Genevieve Productions. Ben Stewart and Tom Veracruz helped make the program possible. Until next week, good night from Chicago.
What if your cell phone could fly? You may ask, why would anyone want a flying cell phone? Well, you wouldn't, but that's what you generally get if you're in a crash. It often flies out of reach. You're much better off with OnStar Automatic Crash Response. In a crash, built-in sensors can automatically alert an OnStar advisor, who's connected right into your vehicle and can direct emergency help to your exact location. And that's a lot more useful than a flying cell phone. Visit OnStar.com for details and system limitations.